looked first at the coffin and then at the grave. And when, for the first time, he paled a little beneath his tan and stared desperately about him as though hunting for the face of a friend, Jeff saw with astonishment that he was only a boy. The sergeant of the guard directed the prisoner to be seated on the coffin. Shaking his black head, the doomed youth refused and stood facing the firing squad defiantly, his hands tied behind him. Jeff marveled at the rebel's courage. His high cheekbones, brown skin, and straight black hair showed he had Indian blood.
"He's a rebel spy," hissed somebody. "They caught the sneaking bugger behind our lines with a tissue drawn of the fort's new breastworks hidden the sole of his boot. When they tried to get him to talk, he just laughed at him."
"He ain't laughing now," somebody else added. Shivering, Jeff breathed a silent prayer for the prisoner, praying that he would not lose his courage during the ordeal ahead. When the provost marshal stepped up to blindfold him, the rebel brushed him away for a moment and turned his clenched, youthful face southward for one final farewell look across the river to the land of his people and his home. Then the blindfold was tied around his eyes, and he stood impassively, his black hair disheveled by the wind, while the official order of execution, signed by Clardy, was read by the provost marshal. Suddenly, Clardy swore fiercely and sprang forward. One of the men in the firing squad had fainted, dropping his musket and tumbling on his face in the wet grass. Clardy stood over him, drawing back his boot as though to deal him a kick. But he restrained himself, and while the surgeon came forward and worked to restore the man to consciousness, Clardy wheeled and began stamping down the long line of troopers, his nervous eyes darting from side to side as he searched for a replacement. Every man in the company stood rooted in his tracks, afraid he would be the unlucky one. The captain halted in front of Jeff. His wild, suspicious eyes burned with triumph.
"Bussy!"
Jeff felt the marrow freezing in his bones.
"Yes, sir."
Clardy gestured toward the man who had fainted.
"Take his place in the firing squad."
A slow anger burned in Jeff. Sweat formed on the insides of his palms. He wanted no part of shooting down anybody who stood helpless with his hands tied behind him. Defiantly, he squared his shoulders.
"Sir, I will not."
A murmur of surprise broke from the ranks. Clardy's face reddened with rage. Half drawing his saber, he fixed upon Jeff a look of hatred. At that moment, the surgeon came hurrying up and saluted.
"Sir, the man who fainted has recovered. He's back in his place now with the firing squad."
Clardy scoured him with a look that had murder in it. Suddenly, his voice went woman shrill.
"Don't think you're going to escape seeing the execution, Bussy. And soon as it's over, I'm arresting you for disobedience."
Wheeling, the captain stamped back to his place by the firing squad. Glaring at the sergeant, he nodded curtly, his face hard and merciless. The sergeant barked an order. The firing squad raised its muskets. The click of the hammer sounded above the wind. At the command, "Fire!" Jeff felt a weakness in the pit of his stomach and his toes contracted in his wet shoes. Then the simultaneous discharge of the 10 guns, muffled by the wind, brought a merciful end to the scene. The body was placed in the open coffin, and the company was made to march past and view it. While the line in front of him was filing slowly past the casket, Jeff saw Leif Appelman, one of the guards, pile something in a small heap on top of the foot of the coffin.
"Them's the dead man's personal belongings," somebody whispered in awe.
Suddenly, the morning sun broke through the fast, scudding clouds, glinting brightly off something golden lying on top of the pile. Jeff saw it was a gold watch, the handsomest he had ever seen, lying on its glass face. A name was engraved across the back. When he saw the name, his hands shook and his face turned to ice. Trembling, he hoped he had read wrong. He hadn't. The name was still there, plainer than ever, In small, neat script, it said, Lee Washburn. Jeff's hunt for Lucy's brother was over. A hot and bitter rage at Clardy flared in Jeff. He knew he had to think fast or Lee Washburn would lie forever in a nameless grave. Quickly, he turned to Noah. Pressing two shin-plaster banknotes, all he had in Noah's hands, he explained, talking fast.
Noah, the boy Clardy just had shot is the son of that rebel family our officers boarded with a year ago at Tahlequah. We've got to get his body back to them. I'd go, but Clardy is going to arrest me. Go to Sergeant Pike and claim the body. Ask him for permission to go find Old Belle, the old woman who lives in that run-down store at the crossing of the Illinois River. She knows the Washburns in Tahlequah. Tell her what happened. Give her this money, and tell her to hire somebody to help her take the boy's body back to his folks in Tahlequah. It's only 20 miles from here.
Noah nodded gravely. I'll do it, youngster.
And be sure to have her explain to his folks that you, nor I, nor none of our enlisted men here had anything to do with this awful thing, or even knew who the boy was until just now, when we saw his name on the watch.
The sergeant walked up and said briskly, You're under arrest. Captain's orders. Jeff hardly heard him. He knew Lucy would blame him for her brother's death. She always blamed him for everything connected with the war. That night he sat glumly on a cot in the fort's small guardhouse, surrounded by four whitewashed walls. He kept fretting about the terrible surprise in store for the Washburn women when Old Belle arrived with the body of the only son. He tried to estimate the old woman's arrival by the fort's various bugle calls. At the dinner call he told himself, She's on her way now. At Tattoo, he figured she was nearing the river crossing, close to Tahlequah. At Taps, he knew she must be almost there. Still agitated, he went finally to sleep. Next morning, he awoke more depressed than ever. He ate very little breakfast. He knew that, barring an accident, Old Belle had probably completed her sad errand of mercy, and that at last the Washburns were alone with their dead. As commander of the fort until Phillips returned, Clardy had supreme authority in fixing Jeff's punishment, and he made the most of it. Jeff was required to forfeit a month's pay and carry two heavy saddles around and around the fort's palisades in the heat of the day. Whenever a horse died, it was his task to bury it. Clardy was clever at varying the punishment. Once, he had Jeff tied by the thumbs from a tree limb, permitting only his toes to touch the ground. However, the guard, who hated the captain, loosened the cord so that Jeff could drop down flat on his feet and rest, tightening them only when another guard warned him the captain was coming. Jeff bore all the punishment manfully. Finally, on July 13th, he was released and returned to duty. On the same afternoon, General Blunt arrived at the fort with reinforcements from Kansas. There were two companies of the 6th Kansas Cavalry with him. Mingling with him, Jeff learned that a Union force sent out by Blunt had successfully defended a big Union wagon train from an attack by Stanwady's rebels, and that the train was now only a mile from the fort. There was bigger news than that, too. Before leaving Fort Scott, Blunt's command had been notified of the defeat of the rebel General Robert E. Lee at Gettysburg, and of the surrender of the rebel port of Vicksburg to General Ulysses S. Grant. In nearby Arkansas, the Union General Prentiss had inflicted an overwhelming defeat upon Confederate troops led by Generals Holmes and Price. Everything looked much brighter for the Union cause. That night, Jeff went on sentry duty again. This time, his beat was in the timber southeast of the fort, where the newly arrived cavalry had camped. He had supposed that General Blunt would prefer to sleep in a bed in one of the commodious rooms in the officers' barracks. But to his surprise, he discovered the general's large brown Sibley tent, its edges raised from the ground for ventilation, pitched in the timber with his command. After taps were blown, the general's tent was the only one in camp with a light. As Jeff, followed by his dog, walked back and forth past it. He could hear the scratching of the general's pen as Blunt worked busily into the night on his dispatches. Shortly after the sentries had called 1 o'clock in the morning, Blunt emerged from the tent. Walking to the fire, he stooped, lifting a small kettle off it. He poured a steaming, dark-colored liquid into a small metal cup. Adding sugar, which he took from an envelope in his shirt pocket, he raised the cup to his bearded lips as though to drink from it. Changing his mind, he set the cup on a rock, probably to let it cool. Sniffing, Jeff couldn't detect the odor of coffee. He figured the drink was hot tea. The dog was watching the general, too, her plumed tail waving slowly in the reflected firelight. Suddenly, she trotted over to the rock, thrust her slender nose into the cup, and began to lap up the tea. With a bellow of irritation, the general rushed to drive her away. At the same time, a wild, savage barking came from inside the tent. Apparently, Blunt owned a dog, too, but he kept it tied. Dixie, her ears flattened and her tail down, bolted from the scene. Gaping, Jeff shrank back into the darkness. He hoped the general hadn't seen him. When he finally got to bed at 2, he heard raindrops pattering timidly on his tent, and then swelling into a steady deluge. Next morning, Blunt's orderly came to Jeff's company headquarters shortly after reveille. He conferred a moment with Clardy, who barked something at a sergeant. The sergeant sloshed down the muddy company street, bellowing, "Private Bussy!" Jeff was busily digging trenches to divert the rainwater that flowed everywhere. He looked up, leaning on a shovel.
"Here, sir."
"Report immediately to General Blunt."
"Yes, sir."
Jeff's face paled beneath its tan.
He knew what the summons was for. The general had made inquiries about the dog that had drunk his tea. Everybody in the regiment knew Dixie and to whom she belonged.
Jeff followed the orderly, buttoning his jacket with fumbling fingers. As they marched up to Blunt's tent, Jeff wondered what his punishment would be this time. He didn't want any more of the ditch crew, or the road crew, or the horse-bearing crew.
"Wait here," said the orderly.
Pausing a moment to look about him, he whispered behind his hand to Jeff,
"And when you go in, watch out for his bulldog that he keeps tied up. He's mean. If you get in range of him, he'll bite a chunk out of you so big it'll look like a bear chawed you."
Jeff thanked him and snorted to himself. He'd take his chances with the bulldog. The general was what he feared most. He took off his cap and tried to part his rumpled hair with his fingers. The orderly came out and held the tent flap open for him.
"General Blunt, we'll see you now."
Jeff took a long breath and licked his lips nervously.
"Yes, sir," he said,
and ducked inside. Chapter 17. The Ride of Noah Babbitt. It was dark inside the tent, save for a candle that flickered brightly from the far end, throwing moving shadows on the brown canvas walls. The air was clean and damp, with a slight, pleasant smell of tobacco and pomade. Despite the night's rain, the bottom canvas had been raised 6 inches. A bayonet stuck into the earthen floor held the candle on its round, upthrust end. In the weird half-light cast by the candle, there was a small table covered with maps and papers, and behind the table sat General Blunt. The general was wearing his blue dress coat, but this time the brass buttons at the top were undone, and his white shirt front showed at his open throat. His strong, mustached face was thrown partially in shadow, accentuating its swarthiness. He raised his dark, quizzical eyes. Jeff saluted.
"Sir, the orderly said you wanted to see me."
Gesturing slowly with one hairy hand, Blunt indicated a camp stool. Jeff sat down.
This was it. He was on the general's blacklist. As fast as he worked off his punishment for one officer, he was back in hot water with another. This time, he had outdone all his previous efforts.
He had incurred the wrath of a general, the commander-in-chief of the entire Kansas department. He swallowed resignedly. Anything but the stump-digging detail or the horse-burying crew. Something nudged his leg. A large tan-and-white bulldog, tied by a leather leash to a tent pole, was sniffing at his trousers. Forgetting the orderly's well-meant warning, Jeff reached down automatically, as he did with all dogs, and began to rub the bulldog's ears. The general grunted suddenly.
"How would you like to be a scout?"
Jeff was so jarred by the unexpected question that he sat speechless. His first thought was of Lee Washburn and the execution on the drill grounds. Sometimes scouts didn't get back alive.
"General, I don't know anything about it. I'm afraid I wouldn't be any good at it."
The general looked annoyed. He threw back his massive shoulders.
"That's what your captain thinks, too. In fact, he went further and said some harsh things about you and about your attitude. Your record with him is very bad. But I saw you in action at Prairie Grove. I think you'd do all right. That's why I called you in to talk to you."
"Thank you, sir. But I'm afraid I hadn't better. I haven't had any training for that kind of work. I'd probably mess things up."
Jeff could still hear the fife squeaking the death march and see the lonely, bitter look on Lee Washburn's face as he stood by the cheap pine coffin just before they shot him. Blunt scowled and took a long drink from a small tin cup on his table. His deep bass voice seemed to rumble from way down in his black boots.
"Colonel Phillips tells me that he has trouble getting information about the enemy over the river. He says he sends out spies, but they don't come back. I think all his scouts have sold out to the enemy. So, I've decided to organize my own. I've got to have information about the enemy, and I've got to have it quick."
Jeff stopped scratching the bulldog and squirmed on the stool. The general didn't seem to be paying any attention to his lack of enthusiasm. He guessed that a soldier should always do what his commander asked, regardless of the risk. Anyhow, this might be far better than the punishment he was expecting. Maybe he ought to look into it a little further.
"Sir, if I became a scout, how would I go about it? How would I get across the river? What would I be expected to do after I got across?"
"Can you swim? Can you ride a horse?"
"Yes, sir."
Blunt put his cup down and belched delicately.
"We will escort your patrol across the river and post a guard there until you return. You will ride behind the enemy lines and try to capture some of his soldiers and bring them back with you. It is imperative that you do bring back enemy prisoners. Try to take at least two or three, so we can question them separately and cross-check their stories. Also, keep your ears open for any other information regarding the enemy you might hear."
"Like what, sir?"
Jeff couldn't help noticing that the general was now speaking in the present tense, as though he had already agreed to accept the dangerous mission.
"Like trying to find out if Cooper has any reinforcements coming up from Texas. I want an estimate of all Cooper's forces south of the river, how much artillery he has, the extent of his earthworks, anything you can find out about their supplies, morale, position, names of their most prominent officers. But the main thing is to bring me back some prisoners."
Jeff nodded uneasily. He'd be lucky if he got back across the river himself. Still, he had joined up to get the war over with quickly as possible. Maybe this would help speed things up.
"The river's up. Cooper has dug rifle pits and posted heavy picket stations at every ford. But we'll get you across some way."
"Yes, sir," said Jeff.
His skin began to goose pimple, half in excitement, half in fear. Then a disquieting thought struck him.
"General," he blurted, "could I have a new horse? The plug I've got now is a good cavalry horse, but he's so poor his ribs look like bed slats. The rebels have got good horses. They outrun ours every day."
Blunt nodded soberly.
"That's because the grass has already risen in Texas. Their horses are further along than ours. But you'll get the very best stock we've got. Report at once to Lieutenant Orff. He's in charge.
The general stood. Jeff stood too, saluting. He turned and left the tent. He was now in the Union Scouts. 3 hours later, the Union patrol of 40 men started. The sky was cloudy. At first, they traveled in the timber so the rebels couldn't see them from the opposite shore. Despite his lack of horsemanship, Noah was in the patrol too, his tall body bouncing up and down as he sat his mount awkwardly, one hand tightly gripping the saddle gullet. After they'd ridden for 2 hours, they turned southward through the trees searching for the river. Jeff guessed they would avoid the fords, heavily guarded by the rebels, and try to cross at a deep spot. Soon, he could hear the Arkansas gurgling noisily ahead and smell the earthy odor of its brown flood waters. They rode up to its north bank and stopped near a gigantic black walnut tree. The sun broke momentarily through the clouds, lighting up the tip of each dirty brown wave. Heavily swollen by the rains, the stream looked a quarter of a mile wide and was running bank full. Jeff doubted if they'd ever get across. Orff, a blonde Missourian with a big Roman nose, left a dozen men in the tall grass on the Union side of the water, Noah among them. He sat down, pulled off his boots, and tied them on his saddle. Jeff did the same. Orff also took off his trousers and tied them by the legs around his neck. Then his sharp hazel eyes fell on something fastened to his saddle. It was a rifle scabbard of soft, tan leather, and Jeff could tell from the shape of it that there was a gun inside. For a moment, the lieutenant hesitated, as though debating whether to risk wetting it in the river water. With a grunt, he disengaged the sheathed weapon from the saddle and handed it to the corporal of the detail staying behind on the shore.
"Don't lose it," Orff charged seriously. "Let me have your carbine."
Quickly, the trooper made the exchange, unslinging his weapon from his shoulder. Orff looped it around his own neck. Shifting his pistol and ammunition as high as possible, he thrust his bare foot into the stirrup and swung into the saddle.
"Let's go," he said, and urged his black horse into the flooded stream, the others following.
They crossed the river without trouble. Jeff liked the dun that had been issued to him. He was splendidly formed from the loins forward, and his legs were flat and clean. He had endurance, and he could move. He didn't like to walk, preferring to be ridden at a canter or a lope. Jeff found he could guide him with the outer knee. Twice he felt the cold water rising to his crotch, but since he rode naked from the waist down, he kept his clothing and his weapons dry. On the rebel side of the stream, Orff planted another dozen men in the willows. Then, taking Jeff and 14 others, he spurred southward through the timber.
"They won't be looking for us," Orff reasoned, his mouth full of fresh chewing tobacco. "They'll probably figure the river's too high."
With a striking motion of his chin, he spat an amber stream at an alder bush and wiped off his mouth with the palm of his hand. Jeff hoped the lieutenant was right. But this was rebel territory, and they might meet a rebel patrol at any time. Their guide was an Indian lad from Drew's Union Indian Brigade, who had once lived in this area. Orff called him Frank. They rode at a swinging trot, and as the sandy trail, bordered by willow and tamaracks and Indian grass, opened ahead of them, Orff sent out flankers on both sides. Another hour, and they came upon the Fort Smith Road, a wide, sandy, wagon-rutted thoroughfare over which Cooper, the rebel Indian commander, kept in constant communication with rebel forces in nearby Arkansas. It was bounded on both sides by pine, hickory, and oak. Orff raised his right fist and the column halted. There was nothing in sight. All Jeff could hear were the mockingbirds singing their heads off in the oaks. Orff looked shrewdly around him at the thick underbrush, mostly dogwood, strawberry bush, and pawpaw.
"Let's hide here and see what comes along."
The lieutenant planted a guard half a mile up the road in either direction and concealed his main force in the roadside brush. Jeff, the guard on the west approach, guided the Dun behind a clump of alder, where he had a clear view of the road. As he adjusted the one-shot pistol in his waist, his nose caught the resinous whiff of pine needles as the hot sun shone on them. Big, yellow-bodied grasshoppers arose from the grass clumps and cruised in the warm sunshine, snapping noisily while in flight. For 2 hours, nothing happened. Suddenly, Jeff heard shots down the road, then men shouting and horses running. Apparently, Orf's patrol had jumped a small party of rebels. Jeff grasped the Dun's bridle reins and listened nervously. Sounded as if the chase was going away from him. He had just decided to follow when he heard hoofbeats coming up the road. A single horseman, clad in Confederate gray, hove in sight, galloping easily, as though bound for a far-off destination. He was an older fellow, good-looking, with low black sideburns showing beneath his gray campaign hat. Instantly, Jeff drew his pistol, and putting spurs to the Dun, burst from the woods and rode straight across the rebel's path.
"Halt!" he cried. "You're my prisoner!"
The rebel seemed to have a different opinion. His face white, he ducked behind the horse's neck, snatched a pistol from his belt, and threw a quick shot at Jeff. The bullet missed, and the rebel horse reared, neighing shrilly. Cursing, the rebel dropped his pistol, got both hands on the reins, and turned his mount off the road into the trees. Jeff followed closely, holding his unfired pistol shoulder high. Their orders were to take prisoners without shooting them, if possible. Both horses were galloping almost at full speed, but the Dun, hunching himself low as he skimmed over the ground, quickly overhauled the rebel horse. Abruptly, the rebel horse stumbled, spilling the rebel from his saddle. Riding past him, Jeff heard the heavy thump of his body as he fell in the sand. Elated, Jeff sawed at the Dun's reins. Finally, he got the Dun turned and retraced his steps. For 5 minutes, he carefully combed the dark pine scrub and sumac, but there was no sign of the rebel. All he found was the rebel horse grazing quietly in the woods. She was a small black mare. On her back was a shallow Mexican saddle, a haversack lashed to its large flat horn. Jeff switched the haversack to his own saddle and, leading the rebel mount, rode slowly back over his tracks, taking one final look. But the man had vanished.
"Corn,"
Jeff growled, thoroughly chagrined. He put the Dun at a gallop, heading back to the river as Orf had ordered him to do if they became separated. He figured some of the rebels had probably escaped and would quickly bring back cavalry to intercept Orf's patrol. Better get home before it was too late. When he struck the river, it was mid-afternoon. There was no sign of Orf nor his patrol. The water had gone down and the stream looked easier to ford. Finally, he saw the gigantic black walnut tree on the opposite bank. Gratefully, he pulled rein.
"Bussy,"
somebody called in a low voice. The patrol was waiting for him in the brush. Orf rode out of a clump of cottonwoods. From collar to cuff, the lieutenant's blue uniform was soiled with mud. He frowned anxiously as he saw the extra horse, its saddle empty. "What happened?" Vexed at having to report his failure, Jeff told him.
"Did you do any good, Lieutenant?"
Orf gestured behind him at the riverbank, disgust and passion in his tired face. "We got one, but I don't think he's going to live to tell the general nothing. Joe had to shoot him off his horse to stop him. These brush rebels don't know what halt means. They'd rather get shot than captured. Even when you throw down on them, they break and run like turkeys." He glanced nervously up and down the stream.
"Let's get out of here."
"The ones that got away went after help. The woods is full of rebels right now looking for us. We're a long ways from Gibson." They plunged into the dirty water. Orf's prisoner, bleeding from the back, lay on his stomach across the saddle of his own horse, limp as a sack of oats. He looked like an Indian. His black eyes were open, and he was moaning with every step his horse took, his arms dangling, his black hair fluttering in the breeze. Orf rode alongside him in the water, one hand on the back of the rebel's saddle. When the horses swam, he steered his mount with his knees, using his hands to hold the rebel's face out of the water so he wouldn't drown. As they waded out on the north shore, Jeff saw the Union troopers rise cautiously out of the green river cane, only their black hats and white faces showing. They gawked curiously at the wounded prisoner.
"They got one.
Looks like a Creek or a Choctaw. He sure looks bucked out.
Dead as Santa Ana. Just as well get a shovel and cover him up."
Orff still didn't like the situation. He unslung the carbine he had borrowed and returned it to its owner, reclaiming his own beloved gun. He tied it securely to his saddle and barked an order.
"Mount!"
While they ran to get their horses, he walked over and looked anxiously at the prisoner, examining his wound. Then he shook his head. The man was obviously dying. They took him with them anyhow, traveling at a gallop. One trooper rode double behind him, holding him on. As usual, Noah was having trouble staying in the small army saddle. It was a McClellan, just rawhide fitted over a hardwood tree. It had no horn. His red face screwed in pain. He sat straight up, one hand on the reins and the other clutching the saddle's gullet, his long legs clinched tightly against the horse's sides. When they stopped at a small creek, the prisoner looked more dead than alive. The panting horses thrust their muzzles gratefully into the water, their wet sides heaving. The prisoner was lifted off his horse and laid on the grass at the creek bank. Orff lifted his head, his empty canteen in one hand. He had the other arm under the prisoner's neck. He looked around.
"Anybody got any liquor?"
Nobody answered.
"Lieutenant," Jeff said, "this water looks cool over here. I'll get some in my canteen. Maybe we can get some down him."
Leading the dun, Jeff headed for the shady spot. It was there the rebel cavalry struck. Jeff was on one knee emptying the stale water out of his canteen when suddenly he heard the rebel yell. A long, low-pitched howl that swelled into a couple of high-pitched yelps and a long, shrill scream, all of it in one breath. A long line of brown-clad figures, all mounted, bulged suddenly into the clearing, fanning out. They were 100 yards away, but coming like the wind, pistols, carbines, and shotguns in their hands. There must have been 75 or 80 of them. A rebel ball clipped off a sunflower 6 inches from Jeff's nose, as though somebody had severed it with a whip. As he ran for his horse, he wondered with amazement where they had come from. Gunfire laced the clearing, echoing hollowly off the distant timber. Horses' hoofs drumming menacingly, the rebels came on and on.
"Stand and fire on 'em!" Orff roared.
Obediently, Jeff unslung his carbine and crouched in the brush by the lieutenant's side. Noah joined them, his carbine in his hands. Orff reached for the leather sheath tied to his saddle and yanked out a small, shiny, newish-looking gun. Kneeling, the lieutenant pressed the gun's polished walnut stock caressingly to his cheek. Aiming deliberately, he began to pump bullet after bullet into the rebel advance, his muddy face grim with purpose. He fired with unhurried confidence.
"Spang! Spang!" spoke the rifle,
neatly and mortally. Jeff was amazed. He saw Orff knock 2 rebels out of the saddle. While Jeff was reloading, the lieutenant emptied a 3rd saddle and hit a 4th man in the arm. Each time he fired, he worked a lever behind the trigger, ejecting empty shells and pumping new ones into the breech. After reloading laboriously, Jeff raised his carbine for a 2nd shot, leveling down on a rebel who, charging at full gallop, was in the act of lifting his horse in a spectacular jump over the narrow creek. But before Jeff could get the man cleanly in his sights, Orff's rifle cracked at his elbow and the rebel, arms and legs flung wildly into the air, slid out of the saddle and hit the creek with a loud splash. Orff was firing so fast and with such deadly effect that the nearest rebels pulled up, their horses grunting and rearing, and retreated. Most of Orff's men were able to mount. But the rebels wheeled, reformed, and charged again. The lieutenant bellowed,
"Mount and let's get out of here!"
Everybody able to travel hit the saddle, save Jeff and Noah. They ran toward their horses. Jeff was in the saddle and had the dun turned around before Noah reached his horse. He shoved the bay's reins into Noah's hands. Noah dropped them on the ground and stooped to grope for them. The bay began to lunge and back wildly through the brush. Noah, clutching the front and back of the saddle, got one foot in the stirrup. Hopping on the other foot, he pawed the air desperately as he tried to swing his long legs over the bay's back.
"Why, you danged old... Look at the gray devil swarm. What a fool Orf was to stop here. I'm coming, youngster. Wow, dang it! Dang the cavalry and every horse in it."
Now the thicket blazed with fire. Jeff drew his pistol, praying that Noah would mount before they both got killed or captured. Noah had saved his life at Prairie Grove, and he wouldn't leave him now.
"Turn him loose, Noah, and jump up behind me. It's our only chance."
At that instant, the rebels burst upon them.
"Surrender! Surrender!" they cried.
The dun began to rear. Angrily, Jeff jerked him down. He had no idea of surrendering. Surrender meant a long, weary walk to Texas, a terrible ordeal for a cavalryman. And mighty little to eat all along the way. Just as Jeff reached down to give Noah a hand up, the bay leaped forward with the reins flying loose. Noah lay crossways on his stomach in the saddle, one hand clutching the horse's mane. Jeff thought he had been shot. But suddenly, Noah wiggled one leg over the back of the saddle and sat up. He was still wearing his black campaign hat. They galloped off, side by side. Noah was doing some wonderful riding, although not in the generally accepted fashion. Neither of his feet was in the stirrups. Every time the bay made a jump, Noah came down on him in a different place. Behind the saddle, in front of the saddle, onto the horse's neck, back on the horse's rump. He was riding the bay from his ears to his tail, but somehow he was riding him. Suddenly Jeff paled. A fallen cottonwood log of gigantic proportions loomed on the ground ahead of them. Both horses leaped it as one, their bodies describing a graceful parabola. As Jeff squeezed the dun's body with both legs and looked back with horror, he saw Noah disappear entirely from sight. Jeff gasped. Now Noah was gone for sure. His horse seemed to be racing without a rider, the reins flopping loosely in the breeze. Then Jeff saw something that made him yell with joy. A hand was still enmeshed tightly in the bay's black mane. Another hand gripped the back projection of the saddle. Then a long leg appeared over the horse's undulating buttocks, groping blindly for a hold. Noah's black head followed. He had lost his hat, and his long hair was blowing in the breeze.
"Hang on, Noah! Stay with him!" Jeff yelled.
Slowly, Noah wiggled his long body back on top of his horse. Lying mostly on his stomach now, he grasped the bay around the neck with both arms hanging on like grim death. The clamor behind them grew fainter and fainter. With a parting volley, the rebels gave up the chase. Noah and Jeff rejoined their scattered squadron. Back at Fort Gibson that night, an old woman rode into the fort. She had a sack of whortle berries to sell and had seen part of the skirmish. She came around where the cavalry was encamped, seeking to learn how the chase had terminated.
"They came mighty near capturing Lieutenant Foss, didn't they?" she said.
Orf, who had lost his dying prisoner to the pursuing rebels, was in a bad mood and turned away without answering. But another of his patrol spoke up.
"You must be mistaken, ma'am. Foss wasn't in the fight at all."
"Ah, yes, he was," she replied. "I saw him. The rebels saw him, too. I heard them talking about it as they rode back. Their leader said that he had never seen such clever riding in all his life. He said Foss just played along in front of them, riding all over his horse, one leg dragging the ground. He said Foss was teasing them with his horsemanship, trying to trick them into an ambush. But they were too smart to fall into that kind of trap."
Roars of laughter interrupted her. Noah was rubbing down his horse. He looked around at them and spat sideways, slowly and deliberately.
"Go on, you fly-slicers, have your fun. There's no danger any of you being mistook for your betters."
The sun was setting red and clear when Orff and Jeff were ushered into the general's tent. A candle still sputtered in the end of the upturned bayonet. Blunt heard Orff's account of their failure. It took Jeff only 1 minute to tell about losing his man. The general was disgusted. He said,
"Huh. I send out 40 men to capture a couple of prisoners. You're gone all day, you suffer casualties, and all you bring back is one rebel pony."
He looked at them sourly.
"Sir, there was a haversack lashed to the saddle of the rebel I chased. I brought it along," said Jeff.
He thrust it toward the general. It was sealed, but Blunt broke the seal and drew out a letter. As he read it, excitement and pleasure came into his swarthy face.
"The man you chased was Cooper's courier. Now I think I can guess what Cooper's plans are."
Jeff shook his brown head.
"Sir, I should have brought him in."
"I'd rather have this. It tells me more than a courier would have. This is a dispatch from Cooper to General Cabell, the enemy commander in Arkansas, asking Cabell to hurry over here with his army. Cooper knows I'm here. He must anticipate I'm going to attack him. He's right. Maybe I can hit him before Cabell joins him."
Standing, the general began to bellow for his aides. After supper, Jeff looked up Orff. He found the lieutenant enjoying a pipe in front of his tent, trying to forget his unhappy adventures of the afternoon. Jeff saluted.
"Sir, could I see that rifle you used in the battle today, the one you stopped the whole rebel army with?"
Orff's hazel eyes gleamed proudly. The rifle was his pride and joy. He ducked into his tent and produced the gun, pulling it out of his scabbard, and handed it to Jeff. Jeff had heard about the new repeating rifles being manufactured in the North, but this was the first time he had ever seen one. Curiously, he passed his fingers over its smooth barrel of dark steel and its smooth walnut stock. He liked its lightness. Orff took his pipe out of his mouth and gestured with it toward the gun.
"She's a 7-shot Spencer. You load her through the aperture in the butt of the stock. You pump the empty shells out with the finger level there. Ammunition comes ready-made in brass cartridges and will always shoot, no matter how wet it gets. And you can load her on a running hoss."
Jeff shook his head incredulously. He looked down at his own muzzle-loading 1-shot Springfield and thought of all the trappings he had to have to make it shoot once. Powder, charger, cap box, ramrod, mini-ball. He'd believed it the best gun in the world. Now it seemed as obsolete as the ancient muskets George Washington's infantry had used at Valley Forge. He was frankly envious.
7 shots without loading. "Corn," he gasped. "You could load her on Sunday and shoot her all the rest of the week."
"Prettiest little gun I ever owned," Orff said. "I gave $35 for it, all the money I had in the world. She'll shoot straight, too. I went down to the river with it last week and killed 11 squirrels and 13 shots. And I cut the forefoot off the 12th, but he got away."
Reluctantly, Jeff gave the gun back to Orff. As he walked back to his tent in the darkness, he thought what a tremendous advantage an army would have if every soldier in it owned one of the new repeating rifles. Next day was Sunday. Jeff's company, on scout, was camped on the Illinois River, 4 miles south of Tahlequah. He had the afternoon off, so he decided to ride into Tahlequah and see Lucy. He dreaded the trip, but he felt he should say how sorry he was about Lee and tell them how courageous Lee had been. He wondered if Lee's body had reached them safely. They'd probably hate him because his company had witnessed the execution and provided the firing squad. Maybe they wouldn't even talk to him. Lucy would probably blame him. She always seemed to think the war was his fault. Also, he had to find out whether Lucy liked him even a little. This might be his last chance to find out. Blunt was getting ready to jump off on another campaign. There would be a battle, and lots of shooting. Jeff cleaned the mud off his boots with a cottonwood twig. The pistol shot Cooper's courier had taken at him was close. So was the rebel ball that had severed the sunflower 6 inches from his nose. He couldn't hope to keep dodging rebel bullets forever. This might be the last time he would ever see Lucy. Obeying a whim, he took Dixie along. It was almost noon. The day was hot and humid. He jogged the dun slowly so the dog could stay up. It would be a good outing for her. With an air of mingled discouragement and keen expectancy, he trotted into the outskirts of the town. Chapter 18. Sunday. His heart swelling with excitement, Jeff rode up to the Washburn home, and his body stiffened. Both the big log house and the premises around it looked deserted. The lawn was unkept and full of thistles. The empty barn lot was hidden by tall weeds. The Washburn women were gone. Lucy was gone. Appalled, he slid his left hand down the reins and leaned forward in the saddle, scanning the yard. Then he saw that one of the flower beds was planted to potatoes, onions, peas, and beans, and that a kitchen window was open. On a clothes prop in the backyard, a petticoat fluttered lazily in the hot southwest breeze. Swinging off the dun, he tied the horse and the dog in the shade of one of the large sycamores in front of the gate. Walking onto the front porch, he knocked. Inside the house, somebody's footsteps approached. His heart hammered madly against his blue hickory shirt. He squinted anxiously at the brown oaken door, the same door Lucy had opened that hot July morning a year ago. Would she slam it in his face now? Trembling, he swept off his hat. Slowly, the heavy door swung back, revealing a small, aged negress. As she surveyed Jeff's faded blue shirt, his shaggy blue trousers, with the yellow stripes of the Union cavalry down the sides, and his broken but neatly polished brogans, her thin, heavily veined hands began to shake. Jeff asked, "Is Miss Lucy home?" The Negro woman's eyes grew wider and wider, as though surprised that any Yankee soldier knew her young mistress. She shook her head vigorously. The whites of her eyes shone like glass.
"No, sir. She's gone down to Mary's to rub her mother's back."
She started to close the door. Frustrated, Jeff said,
"When is she expected home?"
Before the woman could answer, Lucy's mother came to the door. She walked slowly and heavily. One look at the grief and sorrow apparent in her face, and Jeff knew Lee Washburn's body had reached home safely. She recognized him instantly. She stepped back, opening the door wider.
"Won't you come in, Mr. Bussy?"
She spoke and moved with a well-bred restraint. Her low, deep voice sounded courteous.
"Lucy has gone to my sister's home. My sister has been ill, and Lucy's visit seemed to cheer her. She will be back soon. I know she'll be glad to see you."
"Thank you, ma'am," said Jeff. He knew the odds were about 10 to 1 against Lucy being glad to see him. But he stepped inside. Moving slowly, Mrs. Washburn shut the door behind him.
"Mr. Bussy, first of all, I want to thank you sincerely for your thoughtfulness in connection with my son Lee's death. It has been a sad time for all of us. Belle Lissenby and Mr. Hicks got here about midnight with Lee's body. They had to awaken us. Of course, nobody slept any more that night. They stayed until the next morning, and Mr. Hicks dug the grave. We buried Lee on the same hillside where he and Lucy used to play with their sleds when they were children. It was God's will, I suppose, that my son died so young, but it has been very hard for me to bear."
She led Jeff into the parlor.
It was dark and cool there. He looked around and saw the same armchairs and divan, upholstered in blue. The spinning wheel stood neatly in a corner. The large family Bible lay on the same table. Mrs. Washburn turned around, her eyes wet.
"I last saw Lee one night 4 months ago. He had ridden alone across the river, risking his life to see us. I heard him laugh at the back door and call, half in caution, half in fun, 'Hello, Mama. Anybody here I don't want to see?' And then came that awful night when Belle Lissenby and old Mr. Hicks knocked on the front door you just knocked on. As long as I live, when I hear someone knocking on that door, I shall be reminded of my son's death. It has been sultry today, hasn't it? Won't you sit down?"
"Thank you, ma'am." The back door slammed.
"Excuse me. That must be Lucy now."
She left the room. Jeff stood, breathless, twisting his hat in his hands, a look of shy longing in his pleasant boyish face. His heart was thumping wildly again. He heard Lucy's skirt swishing and her quick step approaching through the back of the house. He knew it was she. When she entered and saw him, her small round mouth parted with surprise. Hungrily, Jeff stared at her. There were faint shadows beneath her eyes. She looked more subdued than he had ever seen her. To his astonishment, she came right up to him and gave him both her cool little hands.
"Mr. Bussy," she said with a welcoming smile, "what a nice surprise."
She sounded as if she really meant it. Flabbergasted, he took her hands and stammered,
Good afternoon, ma'am."
He released her hands shyly and stooped to pick up the hat he had dropped in his confusion. She was brown as saddle leather. There were a few freckles on her nose, and Jeff thought he knew who had been tending the vegetables he had seen in the flower bed. The long blue cotton dress she was wearing emphasized her slim young figure.
"Ma'am, my patrol camped last night on the Illinois River, near here, and I thought I'd ride over and see you."
He halted awkwardly, rephrasing it.
"I mean, see how you and your family were getting along." Corn, there he went, messing things up again.
He had a lot of nerve, announcing he had come to call on her when she wouldn't even wipe her feet on him. But Lucy didn't seem to mind. She looked around for the Negro woman.
"Purse," she called. "Please bring Mr. Bussy a cool drink from the well. He's been riding in the sun."
She turned again to Jeff.
"May I take your hat?"
Jeff looked at it. It was battered almost beyond recognition, but he couldn't help it. It had been months since the Ordnance Department had received replacement clothing from Fort Scott. Ashamed, he thrust it toward her. She took it, watching him, a little smile of pleasure on her face. Then her face grew suddenly grave. She sat down facing him, still holding his hat in her hands.
"Mr. Bussy, I can't begin to thank you enough for your kindness regarding my brother."
She was unable to go on. Tears came into her eyes. She raised her oval chin and went on bravely.
"Our whole family is sincerely grateful to you for going out of your way to do what you did, for sending Lee's body to us so we could bury him decently in our own family cemetery, and for paying Mr. Hicks to come with Belle and dig the grave."
Jeff thought she was more beautiful than ever.
"Ma'am, I'm sorry there was so little I could do under the circumstances."
"Every soldier in our company was made to view the whole thing. None of us liked it. None of us even knew it was your brother until later.
Your brother behaved very bravely. I'm heartily ashamed of my commander for ordering it, ma'am."
She looked up at him, her wet eyes shining.
"Belle told us how you refused your captain's order to serve on the firing squad.
and how you were punished severely for it.
Jeff dropped his eyes uncomfortably. That blasted Noah had done too much talking. Abashed, he shook his head. He didn't want credit for something he hadn't done.
Yes, but ma'am, I didn't know at the time I refused that it was your brother.
He saw that he should change the painful subject.
As I rode up just now, ma'am, I could see that you haven't had a cow for some time. What happened to her?
A shadow passed across Lucy's face.
The Yankees stole her and butchered her calf for veal. They came one morning at breakfast. They took the cow and the calf and all our food, too.
Jeff moistened his lips. Angry at the depredations of his own army, there were laws against looting. Seeing the remorse in his face, Lucy added practically,
"There's no need for you to feel badly about it, Mr. Bussy. You've already shown us how you felt about the cow. Besides, these weren't infantry. They were cavalry."
Jeff felt a slow crawl of shame.
"I've changed services, ma'am, since I saw you last. I'm in the cavalry now."
He looked forlornly out the window where he had tied his horse in the yard, trying to think of something else to say.
"That's my horse out there, ma'am. Would you like to see him?"
They went outside. Jeff untied the dun and got into the saddle. He turned him around a couple of times so Lucy could see how he handled. Lucy stooped to pat the dog and bury her fingers in the thick hair behind Dixie's neck.
"She's a beauty, Mr. Bussy. But why do you tie her?"
Jeff felt his ears reddening.
"So she won't fight with your cat, ma'am."
The corners of Lucy's mouth turned upward, and this time she didn't try to suppress her smile.
"Then you can untie her if you like, Mr. Bussy. Our cat is gone, too. She left the same night the soldiers left."
Jeff fell silent.
Dadgum, stealing the family cat while the family was still on the premises. How low could cavalry stoop?
Lucy sat down on the wooden stile and rubbed the fur on Dixie's back. He told her about Dixie drinking General Blunt's tea, and she laughed merrily. He wished he could make her laugh more.
"Ma'am, I'm a scout now," he said proudly.
Her laughter ceased. When he told her about Noah Babbitt's ride, she listened very quietly, and he saw the fear come back into her face. He guessed he was reminding her too much of Lee. So he switched to other things.
"Ma'am, has your family had enough to eat?" "We haven't had much lately," Lucy admitted, smoothing her skirt over her knees. "It's almost impossible to buy food here now. Since we lost the cow, we have no milk nor butter. And we have no wheat for bread. Father wants us to live in Texas, but Mother hates to leave our home and our furniture. Occasionally, Father sends us a quarter of beef or some side of meat. We have our vegetable garden. When the Union cavalry took all our meat, Mother sent word to Father not to send us any more. She says it's too risky. She's afraid he will try to bring the food himself so he can visit us. The Union army is all around us now."
She looked at him honestly. Jeff liked her for it.
"But that doesn't mean we are starving," Lucy added, smiling. "We'll be honored if you'll have dinner with us. It will be mostly vegetables, both cooked and raw."
Jeff said,
"Thank you, ma'am. I'll be happy to."
He stood and, reaching into the saddlebag on the dun's back, produced a gallon sack filled with shelled corn.
"If you've a small grinder, ma'am, we can have fresh cornbread."
He had swapped a pair of spurs for the corn. Stuart Mitchell had given him the spurs. He had taken them off a dead rebel cavalryman he had shot at Cabin Creek. But Jeff didn't tell Lucy that. As he went with Lucy to the smokehouse to grind the corn, Jeff felt hungry. He guessed you were always hungry in a war. Although the dinner was plain, he was impressed with the heavy silver tableware, the brown plates of stone china, the yellow linen tablecloth, and the brown linen napkins. Purse, the negress, was openly nervous every time she waited on Jeff, and was always careful to walk far around him when she passed.
After dinner, while Lucy helped Purse wash the dishes, Jeff walked outside. He saw that the windlass over the well was broken, and he repaired it. He found hammer, nails, and saw and substituted a new board for a broken one in the small plank walk leading to the smokehouse. He found a sickle